Well, this is the moment. We take your phone calls this hour. David Kessler with us, his latest work, You Can Heal Your Heart. We're talking about grief, the afterlife, and a little bit more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Kessler with us. David, what proof in your mind convinces you that the afterlife exists?
I think that there are just so many things we can't explain, whether in grief people have a haunting, you know, we caught Kubler-Ross and I called it a haunting for lack of a better word, but someone coming back, sometimes giving people information or reassurance, those type of things, deathbed visions. Clearly, there's more, you know, I always say there was a time when the greatest thinkers of this world thought that the earth was flat, and yet there was so much more. You know, I think that our greatest thinkers go, oh, you know, we just know this life. There's so much more, and I think that's beginning to get revealed to us.
But, you know, a lot of this is faith-based, isn't it?
Well, that's what I found fascinating about deathbed visions. It didn't matter what your religion, atheists, agnostics, had loved ones coming to greet them. That's what was amazing. And sometimes they would go, wow, this challenges everything. So it's interesting that when the dead come to greet the dying, they do that beyond anyone's religion.
Well, that's true too. Do you remember the Twilight Zone episode, Nothing in the Dark? It was about Robert Redford was a police officer who was injured outside the door of a little old lady who was petrified to open the door because she didn't want Mr. Death to walk in and take her. And it's an, I'm not going to give it away, but it's probably one of the most riveting explanations of how some people perceive death, and just a great ending. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't. I'm going to look that one up because I love a lot of those Twilight Zones, and, well, I practically love
this,
all of them.
This one you will like even more. Nothing in the Dark, it's called.
Nothing in the Dark. All right, I'll look that one up.
Let's take some call stories. We'll go to Charles, first of all, in Baltimore, Maryland, to get this going. Hi, Charles, go ahead.
Yes, I'm going to tell you about when my girlfriend died. This was in 07.
Okay?
Sorry. And I'll tell you what it felt like. It felt weird. She was sick, and she lived in another state where we were going to get together. And you know, her parents told me, you know, to pray that she makes a recovery because she was in the hospital before and she, you know, made a recovery and such. So after that, her parents called and told me this was on like a Wednesday or Thursday. I forget what day it was, but it was weekday, Wednesday or Thursday. And the weirdest thing happened. They told me. And I ate breakfast, and then I tried to get through the day, but I felt this weird feeling like nothing was right. I can't describe it. But I knew that she was in a better place, and it was interesting how we got back together after 30-some years. It's really amazing. She remembered me, and I remembered her. And it's just a shame that we couldn't have gotten back together sooner. But, you know, things that we didn't cross our paths or whatever. So, anyway, it was tough because the following Saturday I had to go, you know, go out and do something. And I thought for sure something was going to happen. You know, was I going to break down in front of these people? What are they going to say? And all this kind of stuff. And then Sunday, the following Sunday, I had to go out to a christening, and you talk about hard. You know, I almost thought I was going to break down. I almost did. I don't know why that was, but it was. So, you know, it is what it is. But
how long did it take you to get over all that, Charles?
It took a while.
That's an interesting question too, David, in terms of how long does it take to get over grief? Some psychologists had said that, for example, in a bad divorce, that you really don't get through it or get over it. It's normally a month for every year you were married. So, you know, in some cases, if you're married 12 years, it takes a full year to get over it. Do you agree with that?
I've heard a lot of formulas for that. I think it's, you know, it's very individual. But I'll tell you, it's usually shorter than people think. And, you know, I think, you know, what we talk about is an interesting distinction that, you know, you don't quite get over it. It just becomes a part of your life, a part of your history. No one sort of forgets their parents who have died or a loved one, their girlfriend
or
whatever.
No, it's tucked away forever.
You know, would they always continue with us? But that sort of acute, painful experience luckily doesn't last forever. We sort of will always miss them. I say you eventually shift from remembering the person with pain to remembering them with love. That's eventually what you get to. And it's interesting, our caller, you know, there's so many stories out there of people who died and they weren't with them at that moment, but they got a message or the person visited them or something new, you know, that that person had died. Fascinating stories we hear.
How about the old phone calls from someone with caller ID that says 000 or something?
Right.
We've heard those.
And it's interesting, like even Patrick Swayze's wife talked about, she still texts him. You know, and there's the phenomenon now, we've all sort of had it happen, of pocket dialing. Your phone just dials someone.
That's true. Is she getting text responses, though? That's the question.
Right, that is the question. That is the question. One of the things that's interesting about the idea of responses and all that is there is a hospital in Texas. Do you know how you'll hear those things about near-death experience, how in the operating room the person was floating above the room and could tell them later, oh, the doctor said this, and then the nurse said that,
yeah,
and I saw it all.
They were making fun of me, you know?
Right. Or they were discussing their golf game instead of, like, you know. And what they've done in this experiment is they've put signs, you know, the kind of signs you see, you know, when a storefront going open or, you know, special today or whatever,
yeah,
those sort of red scrolling signs and all that. They've put them in the operating room facing upward on the ceiling where no one on the floor could see them. And they're doing this experiment.
Is that Gary Schwartz's experiment?
You know, I forgot the name of the guy who's doing
it. I think it might be.
Right. So I'm really anxious to sort of see what comes out of that.
I'm almost sure that's his.
Right.
He's been on the program a lot.
Right.
Okay, next up, Sue's with us, Rapid City, South Dakota. Hey, Sue. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks again, George.
Sure.
I appreciate it. And it certainly is, David, a real pleasure to hear this because I have been dealing with my family gradually diminishing before my eyes. My grandparents, I was not around. I was in college. My dad died of a AAA burst, and my mom died of severe dementia. And there's an interesting story with that one. My brother was a heart-lung transplant surgeon who said I should have known, but he died of lung cancer and had never, ever, ever, ever smoked in his life. My sister is 82, and I'm the last. And I had my middle son, I had a stillborn. Actually, he's my last son. The stillborn in between the two sons was stillborn. So I've been dealing with the grief process, and I have come to a realization, it's not that I don't mourn and grieve, but with the stillborn, I had a feeling about it. With my grandparents, I knew that it was imminent. With my dad, the same thing. My mom, I prayed because she was, her piano teacher was Franz Liszt, and she was magnificent. And she went back into her room after she'd been in a rec room and had been playing a Schumann concerto, and had never, for the years that I had been with her, had never, was not able to play even Stardust or Deep Purple or the things that she and Daddy loved to dance with.
She got into it moment, though, didn't she?
Pardon me?
She got into it then, though, huh?
Oh, she did. She played the whole concerto without the orchestra.
Hey, Sue, this is David. Let me ask you a question. In your heart of hearts, deep in your soul, all those people who have died, do you feel a connection? They're assembling elsewhere and you'll see them again?
Oh, absolutely. I walk around talking to all of them all the time. But my thing is, I've always been feeling guilty because I didn't necessarily, that it is recognizable, go through a grief process. And my sister hasn't been doing the same thing either. She's very upset about it. And her husband died of cancer, prostate cancer, and that metastasized all over the body. But my feeling is, and I've been thinking this for some time, but thinking maybe it's just irrational to think that it just seems to me that in looking back for these long, long times, that, you know, every time I would see these people, like if I was back on vacation from college or dealing with it or hearing about it, that the person who's dying goes through the same grief process as the person who is the survivor.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. We're going to take some more calls here for you, David, but I think it goes hand in hand. The dying and the living both have the same kind of grief.
Absolutely, and a couple things Sue raises that's really interesting. First of all, when the person who's dying goes through their anticipatory grief, what that looks like for them is they begin to withdraw. They begin to sort of go to an inward place. The other thing that Sue said that's fascinating, and we're getting a lot of new information out of new studies from this, is she said she didn't feel like she grieved as much as, you know, some other people, and she wasn't in pain. We used to have what we called delayed grief. We'd see someone who was doing well after grief, and we go, it's delayed. You know, it's going to hit them soon. It just hasn't hit them yet. It's hard to study grief because you had a loss 3 years ago, she had a loss 10 years ago, that person had a loss 5 years ago. 9/11, those tragedies in our world, while horrible tragedies, they give us a chance to study how people do in grief from one day when a tragedy happened to all of them. And what we're finding out, the people we thought had delayed grief, they're doing too well, they're resilient. They don't go through that painful disruption. And it doesn't mean they didn't love the person. It doesn't mean they didn't miss the person. They just don't have that same disruption. They have a stronger resiliency. And that might be what Sue had, and there's nothing wrong that she's not in deep, deep pain. The love is still there, and she's grieving in her own way.
All right, let's take another call or two before the break. Maria is in Albany, New York. Thanks for holding, Maria. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I think that there's another side that hasn't been touched on. I think most people are afraid of death, and they grieve for people who've died because there's a lot of evidence that it's not necessarily family members meeting and that kind of thing. In other words, we don't really know what's going to happen. And there's a lot of, there was a woman who did a study for decades. She interviewed 3,000 people who had NDEs, and she said that 2/3 of them had very scary stuff. And the Ghost Investigator Society, they have all these children, voices of children saying, you know, where's my mommy? It's cold here. So not everybody's being met, apparently. One last thing, Whitley Strieber and John Lear said that he believes Whitley on this, says that Whitley had experienced something that led him to believe that you don't go to the light when you die, because it's a trick that greys are if you go to the light, that the greys will decide your fate about reincarnation. And John Lear took it very seriously. And so, you know, if we don't know whether to go to the light or we'll be doomed or not go to the light, I think that's pretty intense when you think about death, not knowing what's going to happen to you and what to do.
I'll tell you the thing that I would say, and I respectfully, just from my experience, you know, going to hospices all over the country and meeting with doctors and nurses and being in them, emergency rooms, I got to tell you, I don't see that happening in hospital settings and end-of-life settings. You just don't hear in those settings of people having these horrible experiences. They really do seem to have comforting experiences. And I encourage people to ask their local hospice, ask their doctor they know in emergency rooms about these stories, because the evidence seems to be what's happening. And I always feel like I'm a bit of a reporter from the end of life, that people do seem to have comforting experiences. And while I've heard the other stories that she's mentioned, we don't see that happening in real life in a day-to-day experience.
No.
Thank goodness.
We really don't. But I guess in due time, we'll all find out one way or another what it really is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My father used to say, it's a great adventure. He can't wait.
I'll wait.
I know. Well, you know what? He was in his 80s. He had a long life. So I understand. I'll wait with you.
Next up, we go to Bob in Katy, Texas. Hey, Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, hello, George. I talked to you a long, long time ago. About 9 years ago, I said you said I had a contagious laugh.
I haven't heard you laugh in 9 years.
Well, my laugh has diminished a bit right now. My wife of 30 years passed away just right after Christmas. I sent you an email last weekend. The tagline was, my prayers for your sister.
Yes, I saw that. Thank you.
I asked about a show about this, and here you are today, so I'm really glad. I would like to ask David if the people he has interviewed have any experiences of hearing responses in their mind when they talk to their loved ones. I do hear that a lot, and I don't know if it's my voice trying to imitate her or if she's actually talking to me.
We got about 40 seconds, David.
You know, there's interesting things. People will hear a native language come out of their dying mother. They'll hear stories. They'll hear lots of information they didn't know. So there's a lot of fascinating communication we can't explain that happens at the end of life.
David, for people who want to get your book, where do they go?
One, they can go to youcanhealyourheart.com. There's great videos. There's some free giveaways with the book. If you go to grief.com, you can get lots of information, resources, videos. So two websites for them, grief.com, youcanhealyourheart.com. I'm on Twitter, Kubler-Ross Guy, and Facebook. So you can find me there.
We're going to come back and take final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast show, John Hogue joins us. We're going to talk about prophecy and predictions. Make sure you're part of that program. And we shall be back with final calls with David Kessler. You can heal your heart. Back in a moment. I think Elizabeth Kubler-Ross would be very proud of you these days, David, for what you've come about with your work in the afterlife.
Well, I hope so. It's interesting. She said to me years ago, she goes, do you think you'll ever write about how the dead come and greet the dying? And I said, no, Elizabeth, I want to keep my credibility. And she said, oh, maybe someday you'll have the courage to tell the truth. So I think she would be proud of Vision Trips Crowded Rooms that I finally did.
In her day, how was she accepted?
Not.
At all. Huh?
Not. It's sort of, and it's interesting, even the hospital in Chicago a few years ago, they asked, you know, what do you think her, you know, and they were like, oh, you know, we don't tend to talk about her. I mean, in some ways, she just wasn't accepted. And we forget what she did, that the same way that before Betty Ford, people didn't talk about addictions, and before Michael Landon and Fran Drescher, people didn't talk about cancer. People didn't really talk about death and dying before Kubler-Ross explained a lot of it.
And even with Raymond Moody, it took him a long time to get a status.
Absolutely. He and I did a speaking engagement together. He's a really great guy.
Yeah, he sure is. He sure is. And he knows his stuff.
Absolutely.
Is there a possibility that all of us who believe in the afterlife, that we're wrong and there's nothing?
You know, I'll tell you, of course it's possible. But here's the thing. I lecture all over the country. Once in a while, I'll give a lecture and someone will go, I don't buy that. And I'll go, okay, well, you know what? I don't really believe in gravity, but look, it seems to work without my permission. And in the same way, I'll say, what do you got? And they go, what do you mean? I'll go, well, I don't know. Do you work in an emergency room and people say they find nothingness? Do you work in a hospice? I mean, tell me the evidence that there's nothing. And people don't have a lot of it, but we certainly have a lot of evidence that there is something.
Well, there's got to be something. Too many people have had too many stories. I mean, just the few calls we've had tonight.
Absolutely. It's kind of arrogant to think, oh, we know there's nothing there. You know, we don't really know. And I don't think healthcare workers around the world, families who have loved ones who are dying, I just think it's too common a phenomenon.
Me too. Let's go to Zeph in Sacramento, California. Zeph, hi there.
Hi, good evening. I was kind of caught back with this, the stuff you're talking about. My faith is Wicca. It's a revival religion. And we believe in reincarnation. We believe that when you die, you go to what we call the Summerland, where you go over your life, the things that you've accomplished, and then you decide what you want to work on the next time around and get ready to be reborn. What happened to me that it was kind of interesting as I went to a ritual where we were making contact with relatives that had passed over. So they have one person who is under who can act as a spokesman so your relatives can talk through. And I had asked to see if I could contact my grandmother who had passed over a number of years ago. Well, she came back and she said, well, I'm sorry, but she's in the middle of a card game and she says she can't come right now. So that got rather a chuckle from everybody. But when we get done with the ritual, we're getting ready to go. And part of the ritual is you have a number of priests and priestesses that stand around the outside of the circle, sort of like guardians. And one of the priestesses came to me and said, I have something to share with you. I won't tell you if you don't want to know. I said, sure, what do you got? She goes, well, there's a man that approached me for you. And I said, okay. And she said, did you have an uncle that was a Jesuit? And I said, yes, I did. He says, well, he wants you to know that he's very proud of what you're doing right now. I had an uncle. He was a Jesuit. He passed when I was in my teen years. But as a kid, I spent a lot of time with him. And I really loved him a lot. So it really made me feel good to have that little bit of contact. Because I do believe that the veil between this world and the next world is very thin for those that have already passed over. So they're in our lives. They can see us. And they're just over our shoulders.
Good story.
Yeah, too many common stories like that. You know, information that we get that no way the person would know or how would someone understand that. And one of the things that he mentioned about that sort of doing a life review, Kubler-Ross believed that there will be a life review we'll have, but we won't experience it in the first person. We'll do it as the third person. I'll experience my life the way that I treated you. So if I treated you badly, I'll feel that coming back. If I treated you kindly, I'll feel all that kindness coming back.
That happens. That's how it happens. That's what karma is all about.
What karma is, exactly.
We now go to first-time caller Andrew Long Beach. There you go, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a real privilege to be on and talking to you gentlemen tonight. I lost my wife in 2004 to ALS. And we had kind of a unique situation, I believe, because we had about 3 years of knowing she was going to die. And we talked about it a lot. We talked about before and after she passed. I have one brief story I'd like to say that kind of confirms for me the reality of the spirit world. Happened to me when I was younger in my 20s, living with a couple roommates, and we lived in a house where a man had committed suicide. And being young and kind of disrespectful, we'd occasionally crack some jokes and mention his name, and the lights would flip off and different things like that. And one day I was coming from a party at a friend's house and had to run back to the house to grab a couple things and literally ran down the stairs. My room was downstairs and got what I needed out of my room and was running and actually getting ready to jump up two or three steps at a time. And this entity grabbed me around my chest and stopped me dead in my tracks and held me there. And I finally struggled and pulled him up with me up the stairs outside in my car. He was still there. Drove down the road about a quarter mile, and all of a sudden the energy was gone. That was one of my first experiences. But getting back to my wife, in her last weeks and stuff, she was seeing many spirits in our room. I believe she saw the spirits of her granddaughters that hadn't been born yet. She kept saying there were two kids in the room, and she didn't know who they were. One night, it was kind of funny, she told me, she kind of got my attention and told me that there was one of my friends in the room that was making her uncomfortable. And so I got up and I said, all my friends were going out on the front porch. Got out there, I said, whoever's making her uncomfortable, you have to leave. And I came back in, and she said everything was good, and she was happy.
They listened to you.
Yes. And through that end times, the clarity of things that she was seeing, I was also able to experience with her. It's like everything made sense, and it all comes down to love. Our whole lives, everything else in our lives is pretty much meaningless. It's our relationships and love with one another that is really important in the end. And I had a daughter in sixth grade. I didn't have really time to grieve after I lost my wife. I had to keep my house and keep my daughter afloat and deal with her grief. And it was about 3 years, and I started getting some counseling and stuff, and I counseled for about a year and a half. And by the end, my counselors were asking me if they could use some of my techniques, because they didn't have the wherewithal when it came to loss. And I've been able to help a few people. I think one of the keys to the grieving process, like David said, it's the connection with the spirit, knowing that they're still there. It's a touchy situation.
Did you ever have any doubts, Andrew, about the existence of the other side?
No. Like I said, with that one experience I had when I was younger, I've always been very convinced that there's something else there. When something grabs you and stops you on in your tracks on a dead run, that was kind of scary, but at the same time, it really didn't scare me. I kind of knew what it was. And so I've been, very convinced that there's, when we leave here, our energy stays around. Situations with my wife after she left, I felt like she could be anywhere she wanted to be and with any one of us in the family that needed her to be there. And I know she was with me,
Well, it sounds like you did a great job coping. Go ahead, David.
And I'll tell you, he brings up some great points. One, I love about, his therapist asked him about his techniques, because really, Kubler-Ross even said this, the dying are our teachers. And when you go through grief, you become the expert, people who have been through it. And he mentioned, he didn't get a chance to experience grief for a while because he was so busy with life and all that. If you can't experience your grief, it's safely held for you till you're ready to tackle it. It's not something you have to do once and otherwise you miss the chance. And I love his story that, he knows his wife lived on. Sounds like she may have experienced those crowds, the people, the spirits that were gathered there for her. That's wonderful.
Let's go to Edward now in Las Vegas. Hi, Edward.
Hi. Hi, George and David. Well, I'm 87, and I have lost two precious daughters, one by murder and the other by cancer. And within the last 3 months, two sisters have departed, 189 and 184. My perspective is Christian, evangelical, and Catholics all seem to have the same idea. And that is that this body is temporary, but life does not depend totally on this body, that when our body quits, we do not quit. Jesus said, he who lives and believes in me shall never die. And Paul makes it very clear in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 that we're never bodiless, that this body is sort of like a tent or a house that we're in, temporary, and when it quits, we have another one, eternal in the heavens, made without hands, meaning provided by God. So I get a lot of comfort out of this, and I see these precious ones in my family who have departed recently as being more alive than ever. And when I look at their picture, I say, Lord, convey my love to that person. I call them by name. Lord, convey my love to that professor or another professor from college or graduate school that I thought a lot of, or some friend that is gone. So to me, it's a great promotion. It's not a defeat, but a great promotion. And yes, I do believe that we will be met by loved ones. I see no reason why we should not pray and ask God to convey our love to them.
I'll tell you one thing that, you know, you bring to mind. One, I love your comfort that you have found and your conviction. And you know, I think about, you know, I can't imagine a loved one being murdered. And one thing that people have told me over and over is that the spirit knows when the body's going to die, and it doesn't stay around for the horrible event. You know, people want to know, did they suffer? And that's always comforting to me, to know that when the soul knows it's time to move on, we're loved and cared for, and we don't experience those horrific endings, thank goodness. And, you know, I just love that you have such faith there. And there's one, you know, spiritual concept that talks about death will be our reward. Death will be like taking a tight shoe off. You know, leaving the body is just a lot of freedom we don't understand yet.
David, how much can people take? You know, like he said, he lost a couple daughters, a couple others around him, sisters have passed on. How much can people take?
It seems like they can deal with a lot. It seems like they can deal with a lot. And just like him, whether it's their faith they rely on or a spiritual connection, knowing that what we see here isn't all there is.
William is in Bloomington, Illinois. Let's get a few more in here. Hi, William.
Hi, George. David, there's one thing about death. I don't fear it, but I do respect it. Back in the early 70s, and I'm a Vietnam veteran, so I've seen a lot of the misery and the pain that goes along with that. But in the early 70s, I lost my son. He was 4 months old. And he died in my arms. And basically what it amounted to is that we had regular checkups. We thought he was healthy, and the doctors thought he was healthy. But come to find out, he had a peptic ulcer in his lungs, and it burst. And the day that it burst, we just moved into a trailer court. We were just dirt poor, and the phone had been hooked up in our trailer. And when this all happened, my wife went running through the trailer court to try to get help. And, of course, during the day, people are at work. So there was a delay in that. Plus, when she did get a hold of somebody, the ambulance went to the wrong trailer court. But in the meantime, I'm giving my son mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, but I seen the blood coming out of his mouth. I was sucking the blood out of his mouth, trying to save his life. And he was looking at me with half-closed eyes, and it was like saying, Daddy, can you help me? And now I see that image in my mind, and I still have never gotten over the loss of my son, although I have three daughters now, and I tell them, always hug and kiss your child, because you just never know when the Grim Reaper might come to take your child. And I've always had a hatred for that because I thought, why didn't you take me instead of my son?
Yeah.
And I felt that I failed my son because I could not save his life.
No, you didn't.
You know
fail.
What? Your son was here for a brief time and served his purpose. And what an honor it was for him to die there in your arms with you there. And, you know, I believe he lives on in your heart. And it sounds like he's given you so many gifts to make sure you deeply show up for the other people in your life. And I hope you'll hold him again.
Does therapy work here, David?
I do believe it helps. You know, there's something about Freud said, oh, you know, that grief is a natural process that shouldn't be tampered with. But we live states away from each other. People don't want to talk about it now. Bereavement programs really do help. Counselors really do help. Those people around you who can witness your grief, there's something about grief must be witnessed. And we want to heal it no matter what it's from, a loss of a child, a divorce, a breakup. You can actually heal it.
David, I want to thank you for being on the program. Stay in touch. Let's get you back before 2.5 years again, okay?
Thanks, and I hope people will go to youcanhealyourheart.com. Great resources there for people as well as on grief.com.
We've
thanks so much.
Got it all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. What a great guy. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.